Greetings and glacial maledictions, my lugubriously corporeal listeners, and welcome to this February 2015 Science News Update. I'm your host for this maniacally irrelevant science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. To start with, let me apologize for my weather comment last month. I did say that it was a quiet winter so far here, with little snow, and it was actually quite warm. Apparently that was the wrong thing to say. Lo and behold, I recorded the podcast segment in mid-January, and within a few days, we were inundated with massive weekly snowstorms here and sub-zero freezing temperatures. I've had several listeners, including Jack Bachman, Amelia Bernhardt, and Isabel Smith-Lopez, who have emailed and accused me of somehow bringing the snow to New England and the New York, New Jersey areas. I don't think I did that. I can assure you that if I had that kind of power, kind listeners, I would surely be doing something other than teaching college. Seriously, I think the title of Snow Miser or Captain Cold would be very cool, no pun intended, but I really don't think I deserve either of those appellations. Anyway, if you guys just wrote me so your names would be in the podcast, it worked. Let's talk about science. First, red meat, good or bad? Well, for years it's been known that red meat is pretty bad for you, and that eating more than about 500 grams of red meat a week increases your risk of cancer. There have been a whole boatload of studies that have suggested that there is a strong link between the consumption of beef, lamb, and pork products and an increased risk for cancer and heart disease. But although this association keeps turning up, researchers have not been able to really explain why meat seems to confer such a risk. Now a new study published by Dr. Ajit Variki at the University of California in San Diego was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this month, and the study suggests that the source of the cancer link may all come down to, well, a single molecule. The article says that this particular molecule, which is a sugar called glycolyl neuraminic acid, is the first known genetic difference between humans and chimpanzees, and it may be the cause of our little problem with eating red meat. Chimps make this sugar, but evolution selected it for removal from the human genome several million years ago. Lucky us. Variki says, quote, "We first became interested in glycolyl neuraminic acid because of the difference between humans and chimps. But I also have a background as an oncologist and knew that people had reported tiny traces of this molecule in cancer. We thought that cancers must be somehow making the molecule, and it seemed to be the most logical answer." Unquote. Now here's the kicker and what Variki and his colleagues found. Humans do not make glycolyl neuraminic acid, but he kept finding it in these tumors, places where you do not expect it. So how was a molecule that's simply not made by the human body turning up in tumor cells? Variki says, quote, "We lost the molecule at some point thanks to evolution, but then we started eating the molecule. Since it's only different by one oxygen atom, our bodies don't see it as foreign. They take it up. But our immune system, it sees it as foreign, and that should increase inflammation." Inflammation, if you don't realize it, is one of the major, well, thought to be one of the major causes of cancer, or at least it seems to worsen it. To conclusively prove the link, Variki's team created a mouse model that, like humans, lacked glycolyl neuraminic acid and do not make it at all. They fed the animals the sugar and challenged them with anti-glycolyl neuraminic acid antibodies. Those mice not only developed systemic inflammation as observed through increased cytokine response, but they also showed a five-fold increase in baseline cancer. Variki argues that this suggests a direct link between glycolyl neuraminic acid and the increased risks seen in the epidemiological studies. Now, Variki does not want people to panic and cross beef off their diet entirely. He must have been threatened by some very large Texans dropping by San Diego, I suspect. But he says, quote, epidemiologists say that one burger can take 30 minutes off your life. Certainly, our results show why red meat might result in a higher risk for cancer and heart disease. However, we are not saying that eating red meat is a horrible thing that would lead to death by cancer. Beef and pork can be very beneficial foods, especially if you are short on iron and certain vitamins. But it's important to know that it could cause problems in the long run, so limit your intake and be aware of the risks, unquote. I love my burgers. Frankly, I think that the sliders you get at White Castle come close to gustatory perfection. You guys in Europe have no idea what you're missing out on. Well, I guess I'm just going to have to continue eating turkey burgers. It's just not the same. But at least they taste better than tofu burgers. Ugh. One of our fine listeners, Gretchen Tiger, very cool name, by the way, Gretchen. I would love to know the derivation of that last name. Anyway, Gretchen sent in the next story. This story comes out of the journal Nature Communications last month. It was written by Dr. Vito Mocella, a physicist at the Institute of Microelectronics and Microsystems in Naples, Italy. The story concerns ancient lost scrolls. Ooh, visions of Indiana Jones bounced through my head as I read this. The ancient scrolls we are talking about came from the area around Mount Vesuvius and were carbonized by the eruption of that volcano almost 2,000 years ago. Although only a few letters have been deciphered so far, classical scholars hope that the advance could lead to the rediscovery of lost Greek or Roman works of literature in hundreds of papyri that are too fragile to unroll and read. The eruption of Vesuvius in 79 AD obliterated the nearby towns of Pompeii and Herculaneum, but the volcanic ash preserved what it destroyed, including, in Herculaneum, a library in a lavish villa thought to belong to Julius Caesar's father-in-law. The library contained hundreds of papyrus scrolls, dried and blasted by hot gases, and then buried under ash. The library was rediscovered in 1752, and since then, scientists and classicists have sought to unroll the papyri, and read their contents. And they've destroyed a bunch of scrolls in the process, apparently. Some were cut open or unrolled by machine, but they mostly just flaked apart or simply wouldn't open up. Mocella and company say that they can read letters inside the scrolls without unrolling them. Using a laser-like beam of X-rays from the European synchrotron in Grenoble, France, they were able to pick up the very slight contrast between the carbonized papyrus fibers and the ancient ink, which was soot-based and also made of carbon. Once the method is further refined and combined with the mapping of the interior scrolls developed by Professor Brent Searles of the University of Kentucky, we may be able to read many of these Herculaneum papyruses, which have never been unrolled and cannot be touched without causing irreparable harm. We may expect to discover untold treasures of ancient literature very soon. Ms. Tiger is hoping that we will find some of the lost manuscripts that were destroyed in the fires of Alexandria at the famous library there. And we may indeed. I, however, suspect that at least one of the scrolls will say, "Buy tomatoes, olive oil, bread, milk, and collect toga from the cleaners." Next story. Another astronomical record. In the February issue of the Astrophysics Journal, Dr. Tiago Campante of the University of Birmingham in England describes finding the oldest star system yet described. Using the Kepler Space Telescope, Campante has unearthed the oldest known solar system. Five tiny rocky worlds snuggle up to the 11.2 billion-year-old Kepler 444 star. It's a cool red star, more than twice as old as our own. Because planets form at the same time as the stars they orbit, the discovery implies that the universe has been churning out rocky planets throughout its entire history, providing ample time for alien life to develop and perhaps flourish. Kepler-444, however, is not the best place for life to get going. The star's planets, all between the sizes of Mercury and Earth, are too close to it for liquid water to endure on their surfaces. The longest year for any of the planets is less than 10 days long, according to the paper. Campante says, quote, "Planets this small have never been found around a star this old. Old stars don't have as many of the elements essential to planet formation, such as carbon, silicon, and iron, as stars that form later. We once believed that planets could form only around stars rich in these ingredients, and Kepler-444 now confirms suspicions that Earth-sized planets can form around a wide variety of stars." Unquote. I was really surprised to find that Kepler-444 sits only 116 light-years away in the constellation Lyra. For some reason, I expected that a star system that old would be millions of light-years away. It was found by sifting through data from the Kepler Space Telescope. The telescope spent 4 years staring at roughly 150,000 stars, looking for the silhouettes of planets as they passed in front of their suns. To nail down the age of Kepler-444, the researchers measured the frequency of waves rippling across the surface of the star, which show up as tiny fluctuations in starlight. As stars age, the frequency of these waves drops. By comparing the frequency of the flickering light with calculations that describe how stars evolve, Campante's team deducted that Kepler-444 is 11.2 billion years old. The discovery shows that a key necessity for life was present relatively early in the universe, a solid surface to call home. Campante finishes by stating, quote, "Kepler-444 was already 6.6 billion years old when the Earth was forming. That's 2 billion years older than Earth is now. By the time Earth formed, these planets had a huge head start. Modern humans arose in just the last 50,000 years. So imagine having a head start of a few billion years," unquote. I'm not entirely sure what Campante is implying by that statement. Is he saying that we probably missed whatever life may have been in that solar system? Is he saying that having a 2 billion year head start, that they have now evolved into bodiless beings of pure energy, like the Organians from Star Trek? Is he saying that, being ahead of us like that, aliens from Kepler-444 may have evolved beyond a need for a steady diet of reality TV shows? I have no idea. Since we are talking about exoplanets, let's stick with that topic. The end of January brought another exoplanet record. Dr. E.E. Mamajek from the University of Rochester and colleagues reported in the Cornell University online journal Archive a ringed planet that makes Saturn look like an amateur just starting out. The rings around exoplanet J147b have got Saturn beat by a long shot. J147b has 37 rings that extend 90 million kilometers from the planet. That's over half the distance from the Earth to the Sun, and they encircle the whole of that world. These planetary rings are the first found outside the solar system. The rings are probably shaped by moons forming around the young planet, which is 434 light years away in the constellation Centaurus. One large gap in the rings is probably being cleared by a moon less than 80% of the mass of the Earth. Mamajek mapped the rings using data from the SuperWASP project. These are a pair of observatories in the Canary Islands and South Africa. He first reported the rings in 2012, when the unseen planet passed between the Earth and its star, casting a series of shadows toward the Earth that lasted 56 days. The paper suggests that the rings may be common around young giant planets. Debris that didn't fall onto the growing world is left to circle the planet, eventually sticking together to create a family of moons. Actually, Dr. Mamajek's group has been quite busy. They also had a paper come out February 12th in the Astrophysical Journal, which had a bit of surprising news. Most stars keep their distance from the sun. Mobijek's group found that Schultz's star, now about 20 light years away in the constellation Monoceros, is an exception. Roughly 70,000 years ago, the binary star system came within 8/10 of a light year of the Sun. It's the closest flyby known of another star. When Schultz's star buzzed the solar system, it probably slipped inside the Oort cloud, that shell of trillions of comets that envelops our solar system. While such close encounters can hurl a barrage of comets toward the Sun, Schultz's star's flyby apparently spared the inner solar system. Mobijek says, quote, "Using the best available instruments, our simulations suggest that the probability that the star penetrated the outer Oort cloud is about 98%. But the probability of penetrating the dynamically inner Oort cloud is only 10 to 4%, unquote. This strongly suggests that Schultz's red dwarf, brown dwarf binary came in too fast and at too shallow an angle to significantly stir up the inner Oort cloud complex. However, there have been some scientists who have suggested otherwise. Since the Oort cloud is so far away, it would take a while to actually see the effects of the Schultz's flyby. How long? Well, it's been estimated that comets perturbed from the Oort cloud could require roughly 2 million years to get to the inner solar system. So, if that's the case, we have roughly 1.97 million years before finding out if Mobijek was correct or not. If I were you, Dr. Mobijek, I would worry about getting my next grant, sir. You have less than 2 million years before you are proved right or wrong. All right, next story. Diabetes. In the latest issue of the journal Endocrinology, Dr. Thomas Burris and his colleagues at St. Louis University have found a way to prevent type 1 diabetes in a mouse model by blocking the autoimmune processes responsible for destroying the pancreatic beta cells. Type 1 diabetes is a chronic disease that occurs in the body's immune system when it destroys the insulin-producing beta cells in the pancreas. This results in a deficiency of that hormone and hypoglycemia, low blood sugar. Treatments for the disease really only focus on controlling blood sugar levels through taking injections of insulin. Burris suggests that his research could lead the way to preventing the illness instead of just treating the symptoms. He says, quote, "None of the animals on the treatment developed diabetes, even when we started treatment after significant beta cell damage had already occurred. We believe this type of treatment would slow the progression of type 1 diabetes in people or potentially even eliminate the need for insulin therapy," unquote. While researchers already know that at least two types of the immune system's T cells are responsible for contributing to the development of type 1 diabetes, the role of a third type, known as Th17, has been unclear. However, Dr. Burris found that a pair of nuclear receptors play a crucial role in the development of Th17 cells. By targeting these receptors, his group were able to stop autoimmunity from developing in the mouse models and thus preserving the beta cells. Now, I love the way this diabetes story dovetails with the next story about insulin. However, it is kind of a weird story because it has nothing to do with health or humans, and it has a lot to do with predation. It's odd to consider insulin as being any kind of weapon. I mean, so bear with me. Dr. Helena Safavi Hamami at the University of Utah has reported in the Proceedings of the National Academy this month that cone snails can use insulin to act as predators. Looking at a cone snail, you would find the cognomen of predator more than a bit out of place. Cone snails are slow-moving, and they kind of lack anything in terms of fighting parts, at least typical fighting parts. However, they've made up for it by producing a vast array of fast-acting toxins that target the nervous systems of their prey. Safavi Hamami has found that some cone snails add a weaponized form of insulin to the venom cocktail that they use to disable fish. She states, quote, "It is very unlikely that the insulin is serving a different purpose than a weapon. This is a unique type of insulin. It is shorter than any insulin that has been described in any animal. We found it in the venom in large amounts, unquote. A synthetic form of the snail insulin, when injected into zebrafish, caused blood glucose levels to plummet. The insulin also disrupted swimming behavior in fish exposed through water contact, as measured by the percentage of time spent swimming and the frequency of the movements of the fish. The researchers proposed that adding insulin to the mix of venom toxins enabled predatory cone snails to disable entire schools of swimming fish with hypoglycemic shock. Cone snails are abundant in most tropical marine waters, especially around coral reefs. Each species makes a distinct repertoire of venom compound mixtures that have evolved to particular target prey. Conus geographus, a cone snail that has killed a dozen people in accidental encounters, traps fish by releasing a blend of immobilizing venom into the water, according to the prevailing hypothesis. The snail protrudes a stretchy mouth-like part and aims it like a gun barrel at the fish, which become disoriented and stop moving even as the snail's mouth part slowly advances and engulfs the fish. Seeking to understand how the cone snail springs its slow-motion trap, the Utah researchers searched the gene sequences of all the proteins expressed in the venom gland of the Conus geographus. They found two sequences that look surprisingly similar to that of the hormone insulin used by humans, and the insulin genes were more highly expressed in the venom gland than genes for some of the established venom toxins. The type of insulin found in the venom glands seemed to match the prey of a given cone snail. Fish insulin was present in the venom of the Conus geographus and Conus tulipa, which both practice the same fish trapping techniques. Even though it technically has little to do with human sex and reproduction, I'm putting the last story of the night in my usual location for such frivolity. Why? Well, this story has to do with blondes. Now, personally, I have never seen the appeal of blondes, as my wife will certainly tell you. But among many cultures, blondes, both male and female, are highly prized. Again, that is not my cup of tea, but there seems to be a mystique to light-colored hair that transcends races and countries. What does this have to do with the last story? Well, Dr. David Kingsley of Stanford University reported in Nature Genetics last month that the gene that determines blonde hair has finally been characterized. Although blonde hair color clearly runs in families, the genetic variant that gives rise to platinum locks has only recently been discovered. The study follows up on previous genome-wide searches to identify the critical single nucleotide polymorphism and how it functions. A single nucleotide polymorphism is a single base pair change in DNA that can be detected as the difference between one person and another. Sometimes these single changes do nothing, and other times they may indicate serious health issues. On average, there's about 2,000 or so that are different between one person and another. In this case, the base pair change was in the regulatory region of a gene called KIT-LG. The change in the regulatory region reduces binding of a transcription factor called LEF1, which alters growth factor signaling in developing keratinocytes. Keratinocytes are skin cells, and it lightens fur color in mice harboring the human variant. Kingsley says, quote, "The genetic mechanism that controls blonde hair doesn't alter biology of any other part of the body. It's a good example of a trait that's literally skin deep, and only skin deep," unquote. Among the first traits we notice in a stranger is hair color. Compared to other hues, blonde is a virtual light bulb, bright enough to cause us to swivel our necks each time a fair-haired person appears. This fact has been exploited by entertainers time and again. If you look at old pictures before she was famous, Marilyn Monroe's hair was naturally more honey blonde than platinum. In fact, I think Madonna did the same thing back in the 90s so she could look more like Marilyn and certainly stand out more from the crowd of performers around her. Kingsley originally was researching the three-spined stickleback fish, but in 2007, when his team of researchers discovered changes in the same gene that had driven changes in pigmentation in the fish, he couldn't help but wonder does the same hold true for other species? Kingsley's team of researchers snipped out segments of human DNA from a region identified in previous studies of genetic blondness, and then they linked these to a reporter gene that produces a blue color when it's switched on, and then they discovered a single letter of genetic code differed from person to person with different hair colors. And Kingsley says, quote, "When we found the hair follicle switch, we then asked, what's the difference between blondes and brunettes in Northern Europe?" Unquote. After more testing and experiments, the team identified the critical point in the DNA sequence and then engineered mice with each gene inserted in precisely the same way. Next, the researchers produced a pair of mice differing by only a single letter in the hair follicle switch, with one carrying the usual version and the other carrying the blonde version. And what did they find? With only a 20% difference in gene expression, one mouse was blonde and the other one was not. This shows how fine-tuned the regulatory differences are that may produce different traits. Kingsley said in a press release, quote, "We think the genome is littered with switches like this, just like the hair color switch. Many regulatory elements that control genes may subtly adjust activity. A little up or a little down next to key genes, rather than on or off, is enough to produce significant differences." Looking ahead, Kingsley predicts more studies will focus on variations to understand the molecular basis for human diversity, as well as the susceptibility or resistance to common diseases. He says, "Despite the challenges, we now clearly have the methods to link traits to particular DNA alterations." Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Keep eating those tofurkey burgers. Keep watching the skies for those uber aliens from Kepler 444. Maybe they'll have a good cure for heartburn from all the tofu burgers. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Chimp Campanella.